And good afternoon, it's Rob McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading. And we've been reading Charles Dickens's Nicholas Nickleby, which has turned out to be a very interesting social commentary on his time in Victorian England. But before we go any further, a word from the people who helped to make our station what it is.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
David! Where are you?
I'm over here behind all the boxes and the old piano.
I really think we need to get rid of some of this junk, don't you?
Junk? It's not junk, woman.
I know. I'll call Braidwood and District Storage. They have a range of storage units and you can access your treasures 24 hours, 7 days a week. Call us today for a quote on 0407 701 788. Braidwood and District Storage, proud sponsors of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood Servicemen's Club,
your local friendly club.
Whether you're looking for a round of golf, a delicious meal, or a drink with friends, the Braidwood Servicemen's Club boasts a range of recreational and sporting facilities to cater for every taste.
The restaurant provides Chinese and Australian meals and is open for lunch and dinner Tuesday to Sunday.
Braidwood Servicemen's Club, 4842 2108.
Located on the corner of Coronation Avenue and Victory Street, Braidwood.
A sponsor of
Braidwood FM.
Located on 28 acres of natural bushland beside the pristine Mongalo River, Tombara is conveniently located only 15 minutes drive from the historic town of Braidwood, just over an hour from Canberra and 50 minutes from Batemans Bay. More energetic outdoor options are some wonderful bush walking opportunities or in Braidwood, a round of golf, the Heritage Walk or the Braidwood Art Galleries. You can contact the manager on 0448 533 616. Tom Barra, proud to be a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And as always, a big thank you to our sponsors who help to make our station what it is. Well, we've been reading Nicholas Nickleby, and to bring you up to date, there Nicholas is on his way up to the school in York, and there has been a rollover of their carriage. Nobody's terribly hurt, but to pass time at an inn, two gentlemen are going to tell tales or tell stories just to pass the time. We were most of the way through the first one, which was called The Five Sisters of York. And we continue on. Time passed away is a tale that is told faster indeed than many tales that are told, of which number I fear this may be one. The house of the five sisters stood where it did, and the same trees cast their pleasant shade upon the orchard grass. The sisters too were there, and lovely as at first, but a change had come over their dwelling. Sometimes there was the clash of armour and the gleaming of moon on caps of steel, and at others jaded coursers were spurred up to the gate, and a female form glided hurriedly forth, as if eager to demand tidings of the weary messenger. A goodly train of knights and ladies lodged one night within the abbey walls, and next day rode away with two of the fair sisters among them. Then horsemen began to become less frequent, and seemed to bring bad tidings when they did, and at length they ceased to come at all, and the footsore peasants slunk to the gate after sunset, and did their errand there by stealth. Once a vassal was dispatched in haste to the abbey at dead of night, and when morning came, there were sounds of woe and wailing in the sister's house, and after this a mournful silence fell upon it, and knight or lady, horse or armour, was seen about it no more. There was a sullen darkness in the sky, and the sun had gone angrily down, tinting the dull clouds with the last traces of his wrath, when the same black monk walked slowly on with folded arms, within a stone's throw of the abbey. A blight had fallen on the trees and shrubs, and the wind, at length beginning to break the unnatural stillness that had prevailed all day, sighed heavily from time to time, as though foretelling in grief the ravages of the coming storm. The bat skimmed in fantastic flights through the heavy air, and the ground was alive with crawling things whose instinct brought them forth to swell and fatten in the rain. No longer were the friar's eyes directed to the earth. They were cast abroad and roamed from point to point, as if the gloom and desolation of the scene found quick response in his own bosom. Again he paused near the sister's home. And again he entered by the postern. But not again did his ear encounter the sound of laughter, or his eyes rest upon the beautiful figures of the five sisters. All was silent and deserted. The boughs of the trees were bent and broken, and the grass had grown long and rank. No light feet had pressed it for many, many a day. With the indifference or abstraction of one well accustomed to the change, the monk glided into the house and entered a low, dark room. Four sisters sat there. Their black garments made their pale faces whiter still, and time and sorrow had worked deep ravages. They were stately yet, but the flush and pride of beauty were gone. And Alice, where was she? In heaven. The monk could bear with some grief here, for it was long since the sisters had met, and there were furrows in their blanched faces which years could never plough. He took his seat in silence and motioned them to continue their speech. "They were here, sisters," said the older lady in a trembling voice. "I have never borne to look upon them since, and now I blame myself for my weakness. What is there in her memory that we should dread? To call up our old days shall be a solemn pleasure yet." She glanced at the monk as she spoke, and opening a cabinet brought forth the five frames of work completed long before. Her step was firm, but her hand trembled as she produced the last one, and when the feelings of the other sisters gushed forth at the sight of it, her pent-up tears made way, and she sobbed, "God bless her." The monk rose and advanced towards them. "It was almost the last thing she touched in health," he said in a low voice. "It was," cried the older lady, weeping bitterly. The monk turned to the second sister. "The gallant youth you looked into thine eyes and hung upon thy very breath when first he saw thee intent upon this pastime lies buried on a plain whereof the turf is red with blood. Rusty fragments of armour once brightly burnished lay rotting on the ground, and are as little distinguishable for his as are the bones that crumble in the mould." The lady groaned and wrung her hands. "The policy of courts," he continued, turning to the two other sisters, "drew ye from your peaceful home to scenes of revelry and splendour. The same policy and the restless ambition of proud and fiery men have sent ye back widowed maidens and humbled outcasts. Do I speak truly?" The sobs of the two sisters were their only reply. "There is little need," said the monk with a meaning look, "to fritter away the time in gewgaws which shall raise up the pale ghosts of hopes of early years. Bury them. Heap penance and mortification on their heads. Keep them down and let the convent be their grave." The sisters asked for 3 days to deliberate and felt that night as though the veil were indeed the fitting shroud for their dead joys. But morning came again, and though the boughs of the orchard trees drooped and ran wild upon the ground, it was the same orchard still. The grass was coarse and high, but there was yet the spot on which they had so often sat together, when change and sorrow were but names. There was every walk and nook which Alice had made glad, and in the minster nave was one flat stone beneath which she slept in peace. And could they, remembering how her young heart had sickened at the thought of cloistered walls, look upon her grave in garbs which would chill the very ashes within it? Could they bow down in prayer, and when all heaven turned to hear them, bring the dark shade of sadness on one angel's face? No. They sent abroad to artists of great celebrity in those times, and having obtained the church's sanction to their work of piety, caused to be executed in 5 large compartments of richly stained glass a faithful copy of their old embroidery work. These were fitted into a large window, until that time bare of ornament, and when the sun shone brightly, as she had so well loved to see it, the familiar patterns were reflected in their original colours, and throwing a stream of brilliant light upon the pavement, fell warmly on the name of Alice. For many hours in every day, the sisters paced slowly up and down the nave, or knelt by the side of the flat broad stone. Only three were seen in the customary place after many years, then but two, and for a long time afterwards but one solitary female, bent with age. At length, she came no more, and the stone bore five plain Christian names. That stone has worn away and been replaced by others, and many generations have come and gone since then. Time has softened down the colours, but the same stream of light still falls upon the forgotten tomb, of which no trace remains, and to this day the stranger is shown in York Cathedral an old window called the Five Sisters.
"That's a melancholy tale," said the merry-faced gentleman, emptying his glass. "Aye, it's a fair tale of life, and life is made up of such sorrows," returned the other, courteously but in a grave and sad tone of voice. "Ah, there are shades in all good pictures, but there are lights too if we choose to contemplate them," said the gentleman with the merry face. "The younger sister in your tale was always light-hearted."
"Aye, and she died early," said the other gently.
"She would have died earlier, perhaps, had she been less happy," said the first speaker, with much feeling. "Do you think the sisters who loved her so well would have grieved the less if her life had been one of gloom and sadness? If anything could soothe the first sharp pain of heavy loss, it would be, with me, the reflection that those I mourned by being innocently happy here and loving all about them had prepared themselves for a purer and a happier world. The sun does not shine upon this fair earth to meet frowning eyes. Depend upon it."
"I believe perhaps you are right," said the gentleman who had told the story.
"Believe?" retorted the other. "Can anybody doubt it? Take any subject of sorrowful regret, and see with how much pleasure it is associated. The recollection of past pleasure may become pain."
"It does," interposed the other.
"Well, it does. To remember happiness which cannot be restored, is pain, but of a softened kind. Our recollections are unfortunately mingled with much that we deplore, and with many actions which we bitterly repent. Still, in the most checkered life, I firmly think there are so many little rays of sunshine to look back upon that I do not believe any mortal, unless he had put himself without the pale of hope, would deliberately drain a goblet of the waters of Lethe if he had had it in his power."
Possibly you are correct in that belief," said the grey-haired gentleman, after short reflection. "I'm inclined to think you are."
"Why then," replied the other, "the good in this state of existence preponderates over the bad. Let miscalled philosophers tell us what they will. If our affections be tried, our affections are our consolation and comfort and memory, however sad, is the best and purest link between this world and a better. But come, I'll tell you a story of another kind."
And after a very brief silence, the merry-faced gentleman sent round the punch, and glancing slyly at the fastidious lady, who seemed desperately apprehensive that he was going to relate something improper, began. The Baron of Grogzwig. The Baron von Calderwithout of Grogzwig in Germany was as likely a young baron as you would wish to see. I needn't say that he lived in a castle, because that's of course neither need I say that he lived in an old castle, for what German baron ever lived in a new one? There were many strange circumstances connected with this venerable building, among which, not the least startling and mysterious, were that when the wind blew, it rumbled in the chimneys, or even howled among the trees in the neighbouring forest, and that when the moon shone, she found her way through certain small loopholes in the wall, and actually made some parts of the wide halls and galleries quite light, while she left others in gloomy shadow. I believe that one of the Baron's ancestors, being short of money, had inserted a dagger in a gentleman who called one night to ask his way, and it was supposed that these miraculous occurrences took place in consequence,
and yet I hardly know that could have been, either because the Baron's ancestor, who was an amiable man, felt very sorry afterwards for having been so rash, and, laying violent hands upon a quantity of stone and timber which belonged to a weaker Baron, built a chapel as an apology, and so took a receipt from heaven, in full of all demands. Talking of the Baron's ancestor puts me in mind of the Baron's great claims to respect, on the score of his pedigree. I'm afraid to say, I am sure, how many ancestors the Baron had, but I know that he had a great many more than any other man of his time, and I only wish that he had lived in these latter days, that he might have had more. It is a very hard thing upon the great men of past centuries that they should have come into the world so soon, because a man who was born 300 or 400 years ago cannot reasonably be expected to have had as many relations before him as the man who was born now. The last man, whoever he is, and he may be a cobbler or some low vulgar dog, for aught we know, will have a longer pedigree than the greatest nobleman now alive, and I contend that this is not fair. Well, anyway, but Varin von Koldewet without, of Grogswig, was a fine swarthy fellow, with dark hair and large mustachios, who rode a-hunting in his clothes of Lincoln green and russet boots on his feet, and a bugle slung over his shoulder, like the guard of a long stage. When he blew his bugle, 24 other gentlemen of inferior rank in Lincoln green, a little coarser, and russet boots with a little thicker soles, turned out directly, and away galloped the whole train with spears in their hands, like lacquered area railings, to hunt down the boars or perhaps encounter a bear, in which latter case the Baron killed him first and greased his whiskers with him afterwards. This was a merry life for the Baron of Grogswig, and a merrier still for the Baron's retainers, who drank Rhine wine every night, till they fell under the table and then had the bottles on the floor and called for pipes. Never were such jolly, roistering, rollicking, merry-making blades as the jovial crew of Grogswig. But the pleasures of the table, or the pleasures of under the table, require a little variety, especially when the same 25 people sit daily down to the same board to discuss the same subjects and tell the same stories. The Baron grew weary and wanted excitement. He took to quarrelling with his gentlemen and tried kicking 2 or 3 of them every day after dinner. This was a pleasant change at first, but it soon became monotonous after a week or so, and the Baron felt quite out of sorts and cast about in despair for some new amusement. One night, after a day's sport in which he had outdone Nimrod or Gillingwater and slaughtered another fine bear and brought him home in triumph, the Baron von Koldewethout sat moodily at the table, eyeing the smoky roof of the hall with a discontented aspect. He swallowed a huge bumper of wine, but the more he swallowed, the more he frowned. The gentleman who had been honoured with the dangerous distinction of sitting on his right and left intimated him to a miracle in the drinking and frowned at each other. "I will," cried the Baron suddenly, smiting the table with his right hand and twirling his moustache with his left, "fill to the Lady Grogawig." The 24 Lincoln greens turned pale, with the exception of their 24 noses, which were unchangeable. "I said, to the Lady Grogswig," repeated the Baron, looking around the board. "To the Lady Grogswig," shouted the Lincoln greens, and down their 24 throats went 24 imperial points of such rare old hock that they smacked their 48 lips and winked again. "The fair daughter of the Baron von Swillenhausen," said Koldewethout, condescending to explain. "We will demand her in marriage of her father ere the sun goes down tomorrow. And if he refuses our suit, we will cut off his nose." A hoarse murmur arose from the company. Every man touched first the hilt of his sword and then the tip of his nose, with appalling significance. "Ah, what a pleasant thing filial piety is to contemplate." If the daughter of the Baron von Swillenhausen had pleaded a preoccupied heart, or fallen at her father's feet and corned them in salt tears, or only fainted away and complimented the old gentleman in frantic ejaculations, the odds are 100 to 1 that Swillenhausen Castle would have been turned out at the window, or rather the Baron turned out at the window and the castle demolished. The damsel held her peace, however. When an early messenger bore the request of von Koldewethout next morning, she modestly retired to her chamber, from the casement of which she watched the coming of the suitor and his retinue. She was no sooner assured that the horseman with the large mustachios was her proffered husband than she hastened to her father's presence and expressed her readiness to sacrifice herself to secure his peace. The venerable baron caught his child in his arms and shed a wink of joy. There was great feasting at the castle that day. The 24 Lincoln Greens of Von Koldwithout exchanged vows of eternal friendship with 12 Lincoln Greens of Von Swillenhausen and promised the old baron that they would drink his wine till all was blue, meaning probably their whole countenance had acquired the same tint as their noses. Everybody slapped everybody else's back when the time for parting came, and the Baron von Koldwithout and his followers rode gaily home. For 6 mortal weeks, the boars and the bears had a holiday. The houses of Koldwithout and Swillenhausen were united, the spears rusted, and the Baron's bugle grew hoarse for lack of blowing. Those were great times for the 24, but alas, their high and palmy days had taken boots to themselves and were really already walking off. "And my dear," said the Baroness, "and my love," said the Baron, "those coarse, noisy men." "Which, ma'am?" said the Baron, starting. The Baroness pointed from the window at which they stood to the courtyard beneath, where the unconscious Lincoln Greens were taking a copious stirrup cup, preparatory to issuing forth after a boar or two.
"Mine hunting train, ma'am?" said the Baron.
"Disband them, love," murmured the Baroness.
"Disband them!"
cried the Baron in amazement.
"To please me, love?" replied the Baroness.
"To please the devil, ma'am," answered the Baron. Whereupon the Baroness uttered a great cry and swooned away at the Baron's feet. What could the Baron do? He called for the lady's maid and roared for the doctor, and then, rushing into the yard, kicked 2 Lincoln Greens, who were the most used to it, and cursing all the others around, bade them go to, but never mind where. I don't know the German for it, or I would put it delicately that way. It is not for me to say by what means or by what degree some wives manage to keep down some husbands as they do, although I may have my private opinion on the subject, and may think that no member of Parliament ought to be married, inasmuch as 3 married members out of every 4 must vote according to their wives' consciences, if there be such a thing, and not according to their own. All I need to say just now is that the Baroness von Koldwithout somehow or other acquired great control over Baron von Koldwithout, and that little by little, and bit by bit, and day by day, and year by year, the Baron got the worst of some disputed question, or was silly, or was slyly unhorsed from some old hobby, and that by the time he was a fat, hearty fellow of 48, or thereabouts, he had no feasting, no revelry, no hunting train, and no hunting. Nothing, in short, that he liked or used to have. And that, although he was as fierce as a lion and as bold as brass, he was decidedly snubbed and put down by his own lady in his own castle of Grogswick. Nor was this the whole extent of the Baron's misfortunes. About a year after his nuptials, there came into the world a lusty young Baron, in whose honour a great many fireworks were let off, and a great many dozens of wine drunk. But next year there came a young Baroness, and next year another young Baron, and so on every year, either a Baron or a Baroness, and one year actually both together, until the Baron found himself the father of a small family of 12. Upon every one of these anniversaries, the venerable Baroness von Schwillenhausen was nervously sensitive for the well-being of her child, the Baroness von Koldwithout, and although it was not found that the good lady ever did anything material towards contributing to her child's recovery, still she made it a point of duty to be as nervous as possible at the castle at Grogswick, and to divide her time between moral observation on the Baron's housekeeping and bewailing the hard lot of her unhappy daughter. And if the Baron of Grogswick, a little hurt and irritated at this, took heart and ventured to suggest that his wife was at least no worse off than the wives of other barons, the Baroness von Swillenhausen begged all persons to take notice that nobody but she sympathised with her dear daughter's sufferings, upon which her relations and friends remarked that, to be sure, she did cry a great deal more than her son-in-law, and that if there were a hard-hearted brute alive, it was that Baron of Grogswick. The poor Baron, He bore it all as long as he could, and when he could bear it no longer, lost his appetite and his spirits, and sat himself gloomily and dejectedly down. But there were worse troubles yet in store for him, and, as they came on, his melancholy and sadness increased. Times changed. He got into debt. The Grogswick coffers ran low, though the Swillenhausen family had looked upon them as inexhaustible, and just when the Baroness was on the point of making a 13th addition to the family pedigree, von Koldwithout discovered that he had no means of replenishing them.
"I don't see what is to be done," said the Baron. "I think I'll kill myself."
That was a bright idea. The Baron took an old hunting knife from a cupboard hard by and, having sharpened it on his boot, made what the boys call an offer at his throat. said the Baron, stopping short.
"Perhaps it is not sharp enough."
The Baron sharpened it again and made another offer when his hand was arrested by a loud screaming among the young barons and baronesses who had a nursery in an upstairs tower with iron bars outside the window to prevent their tumbling into the moat.
"Ah, if I had been a bachelor," said the Baron, sighing, "I might have done it 50 times over without being interrupted. Hello, put a flask of wine and the largest pipe in the little vaulted room behind the hall."
One of the domestics, in a very kind manner, executed the Baron's order in the course of half an hour or so, and von Koldwithout, being apprised thereof, strode to the vaulted room, the walls of which, being dark shining wood, gleamed in the light of the blazing logs which were piled upon the hearth. The bottle and pipe were ready, and upon the whole the place looked very comfortable.
"Leaves a lamp," said the Baron.
"Anything else, my lord?" inquired the domestic.
"The room," replied the Baron.
The domestic obeyed, and the Baron locked the door.
"I will smoke a last pipe," said the Baron, "and then I'll be off."
So putting the knife upon the table till he wanted it, and tossing off a goodly measure of wine, the Lord of Grogswig threw himself back in his chair, stretched his legs out before the fire, and puffed away. He thought about a great many things, about his present troubles and past days of bachelorship, and about the Lincoln Greens, long since dispersed, up and down the country, no one knew whither, with the exception of two who had been unfortunately beheaded, and four who had killed themselves with drinking. His mind was running upon boars and bears when, in the process of draining his glass to the bottom, he raised his eyes and saw for the first time, and with unbounded astonishment, that he was not alone. No, he was not. For on the opposite side of the fire there sat with folded arms a wrinkled, hideous figure, with deeply sunk and bloodshot eyes and an immensely long, cadaverous face, shadowed by jagged and matted locks of coarse black hair. He wore a kind of tunic of a dull bluish colour, which the Baron observed on regarding it attentively was clasped or ornamented down the front with coffin handles. His legs, too, were encased in coffin plates, as though in armour, and over his left shoulder he wore a sort of dusty cloak which seemed made of a remnant of some pall. He took no notice of the Baron, but was intently eyeing the fire.
"Hello!"
said the Baron, stamping his foot to attract attention.
"Hello!"
replied the stranger, moving his eyes towards the Baron, but not his face or himself.
"What now?"
"What now?"
replied the Baron, nothing daunted by his hollow voice and lustreless eyes.
"I should ask that question. How did you get in here?"
"Through the door," replied the figure.
"What are you?" says the Baron.
"A man," replied the figure.
"I do not believe it," says the Baron.
"Disbelieve it, then," says the figure.
"I will,"
rejoined the Baron. The figure looked at the bold Baron of Grogswig for some time, and then said familiarly,
"There is no coming over you, I see. I am not a man."
"Well, what are you then?" asked the Baron.
"A genius," replied the figure.
"You don't look much like one,"
returned the Baron scornfully.
"I am the genius of despair and suicide," said the apparition. "Now you know me."
With these words the apparition turned towards the Baron, as if composing himself for a talk, and what was very remarkable was that he threw his cloak aside, displaying a stake which was run through the centre of his body, pulled it out with a jerk and laid it on the table, as composedly as if it had been a walking stick.
"Now," said the figure, glancing at the hunting knife, "are you ready for me?"
"Not quite," replied the Baron. "I must finish my pipe first."
"Look sharp, then," said the figure.
"You seem in a hurry," said the Baron.
"Why, yes, I am," answered the figure. "They're doing a pretty brisk business in my way over in England and France just now, and my time is a good deal taken up."
"Do you drink?"
said the Baron, touching the bottle with the bowl of his pipe.
9 times out of 10, and then very hard," rejoined the figure dryly.
"Never in moderation?" asked the Baron.
"Never," replied the figure with a shudder. "That breeds cheerfulness."
The Baron took another look at his new friend, whom he thought an uncommonly queer customer, and at length inquired whether he took any active part in such little proceedings as that which he had in contemplation.
"No," replied the figure evasively, "but I am always present."
"Just to see fair, I suppose," said the Baron.
"Just that," replied the figure, playing with the steak and examining the ferrule. "Be as quick as you can, will you? For there's a young gentleman who is afflicted with too much money and leisure wanting me now, I find."
"Going to kill himself because he has too much money?" exclaimed the Baron, quite tickled. "Oh, that's a good one."
This was the first time the Baron had laughed for many a long day.
"I say," expostulated the figure, looking very much scared, "don't do that again."
"Why not?"
"Because it gives me pain all over," replied the figure. "Sigh as much as you please, that does me good."
The Baron sighed mechanically at the mention of the word, the figure brightening up again, handing him the hunting knife with the most winning politeness.
"It is not a bad idea, though," said the Baron, feeling the edge of the weapon. "A man killing himself because he has too much money."
"Pooh," said the apparition petulantly. "No better than a man killing himself because he has none or little."
Whether the genius unintentionally committed himself in saying this, or whether he thought the Baron's mind was so thoroughly made up that it didn't matter what he said, I have no means of knowing. I only know that the Baron stopped his hand all of a sudden, opened his eyes wide, and looked as if quite a new light had come upon him for the first time.
"Why, certainly," said Von Koldwithout. "Nothing is too bad to be retrieved."
"Except empty coffers," cried the genius.
"Well, they may be one day filled again," said the Baron.
"Scolding wives," snarled the genius.
"Or they may be made quiet," said the Baron.
13 children, shouted the genius.
They cannot all go wrong, surely," said the Baron.
The genius was evidently growing very savage with the Baron for holding these opinions all at once, but he tried to laugh it off, and said he would let him know when he had left off joking. He should have feel obliged to him.
"But I am not joking. I was never farther from it," remonstrated the Baron.
"Well, I'm glad to hear that," said the genius, looking very grim, "because a joke without any figure of speech is the death of me. Come, quit this dreary world at once."
I don't know," said the Baron, playing with the knife. "It's a dreary one, certainly, but I don't think yours is much better, for you have not the appearance of being particularly comfortable. That puts me in mind. What security have I that I shall be any better for going out of the world after all?" he cried, starting up. "I never thought of that."
"Dispatch,"
cried the figure, gnashing its teeth.
"Keep off," said the Baron. "I'll brood over miseries no longer, but put a good face on the matter, and try the fresh air and the bears again. And if that won't do it, I'll talk to the Baroness soundly and cut von Swillenhausen's dead."
With this, the Baron fell into his chair and laughed so loud and boisterously that the room rang with it. The figure fell back a pace or two, regarding the Baron meanwhile with a look of intense terror, and when he had ceased, caught up the stake and plunged it violently into its body, uttered a frightful howl, and disappeared. Von Koldwithout never saw it again, Having once made up his mind to action, he soon brought the Baroness and the von Swillenhausens to reason, and died many years afterwards, not a rich man that I am aware of, but certainly a happy one, leaving behind him a numerous family who had been carefully educated in bear and boar hunting under his own personal eye. And my advice to all men is that if ever they become hipped and melancholy from similar causes, as very many men do, they look at both sides of the question, applying a magnifying glass to the best one. And if they still feel tempted to retire without leave, that they smoke a large pipe and drink a full bottle first, and profit by the laudable example of the Baron of Grogzwick.
"Oi, the fresh coach is ready, ladies and gentlemen, if you please," said a new driver, looking in.
The intelligence caused the punch to be finished in a great hurry, and prevented any discussion relative to the last story. Mr. Squeers was observed to draw the grey-headed gentleman to one side, and to ask a question with great apparent interest. It bore reference to the Five Sisters of York, and was, in fact, an inquiry whether he could inform him how much per annum the Yorkshire convents got in those days with their boarders. The journey was then resumed. Nicholas fell asleep towards morning, and when he awoke found with great regret that during his nap both the Baron of Grogzwick and the grey-haired gentleman had got down and were gone. The day dragged on uncomfortably enough. At about 6 o'clock that night, he and Mr. Squeers and the little boys and their united baggage were all put down together at the George and New Inn, Greta Bridge. And that's our book reading for this week. I've just had a message come in from Billy Bob, who many of you would listen to. There is horrendous traffic eastbound on the King's Highway at Manar. Allow about 30 minutes extra between Braidwood and Bungendore. So lots of traffic, people coming back after the Canberra holiday. So please be careful, take your time, and allow an extra 30 minutes. Thanks for that, Billy Bob. And I'll be back next week with the book reading. Take care, everybody. And one quick community announcement. Just before we go, Dr. Penny Hanley, who is occasionally on Buncombe Faves and Raves, is running a creativity writing workshop, and it will be Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m, 14th of March, 2nd of May, at Bragg. You can book now on 0410506451. There are 8 classes for members, $200, non-members, $240. That's a Bragg offering, and you can contact Penny on the number indicated. Keep well, Braidwood.